CEU Medieval Radio, Past Perfect, the talk show about medieval and early modern culture.
Hello and welcome to the Past Perfect, CEU's Medieval Radio podcast on everything medieval and early modern. My name is Emmy Marinjoy, and I'm joined here by Professor István Petzel. He is the professor at the Department of Medieval Studies, CEU. His wide research interests include history of theology, Greek and Syriac philosophy, Eastern and Indian Christianity. So it's very nice to have you here, Professor István Petzel. So the Department of Medieval Studies at CEU has completed 30 years, and you were always a part of that journey, and you still are. So can you tell us about that journey with the Department of Medieval Studies for the past 30 years?
It was quite a rich experience. I started as a tutor when the CEU building in Budapest was not yet there. So we were in the Buda side of Budapest in some makeshift places, and then the department began its activity. I was just a tutor. I had to mentor a student from Ukraine who ever since has made an interesting career. He is now in Leuven. He has earned his PhD there and is teaching there, and he has become an Orthodox priest in the while. So I was asked to tutor Victor, and apparently I did a good job, I hope so, because 1 year later they hired me as an assistant professor. There was an open call, but at that time that was not very serious, so you had to start somewhere. So people were hired and they were given tasks because there was nothing there. So as it was medieval department, so it was basically the dream of Gábor Klanicai, the late János Bak, who have also co-opted József Lászlóski. And then they somehow imagined how to create a medieval institute. Basically, it was a huge opportunity because there are very few such medieval institutes. And the department has completed 30 years, and now it is merged into the history department. We have fought against this for decades.
Yeah.
But we lost the fight. I hope that the new history department will be as good or even better than we were. The idea was to focus on Central Europe, because there is no such thing ever. And this is a Central European university, and the three experts who founded the department were expert in this. No, but what to do? There has always been a kind of Byzantine connection. So we would need someone like a Byzantinist. And my friend, basically it was my friend György Gerébi, who was also there from the very beginning, although he was hired much, much later. But he was somehow working as a midwife at Central European. He was at the higher education support program and so on. So even before CEU was founded. And he said, there is István. Okay, so they hired me as a Byzantinist for Central Europe. I had no idea about Byzantine connections, some idea I had. I was more interested, of course, in general Byzantine studies, patristics, late antique philosophy. So basically, this is what I introduced here. And then I saw the opportunities, because the greatest opportunity at that time was the influx of highly qualified students from Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. At that time, there was no European accession of the East European countries, and CEU was a unique opportunity. The original idea was, of course, the Central Europe. So originally people thought that we found a Central European university, there would come students from Poland, Czechia, Slovakia, Romania. Yugoslavia was just in the process of decomposing. So this will be a hub for Central Europe. soon, it turned out that this is not a Central European university, this is an Eastern European university, because the real influx of students was from the East, from Ukraine, from Romania definitively, from Croatia. There was a very strong Croatian component at that time, and a much weaker one from Serbia, understandably, because George Soros was very much on the Croatian side. But Romanian students, we had a very good component of Bulgarian students, Ukrainian, Russians. And at that time, we were also doing recruiting, which we are not doing. There was money for that. So it was distributed among us who goes where. And I got the Caucasus. So I was going to, but there were already applicants from Armenia and Georgia as well. So my responsibility became the Caucasus. And so, although I knew nothing earlier about this, finally Caucasian studies were introduced to the medieval departments. We had a lot of, not a lot, but many very, very successful theses defended on Georgian and Armenian subjects. Later it developed into a mobility program founded by the Higher Education Support Program. We had 4 excellent years organizing conferences, hosting Armenian, Georgian, and Turkish, because they are also interested in this region, and Turkish scholars, and sending our PhD students and going ourselves to give courses in Tbilisi and Yerevan. It was really excellent. So what I wanted to say, and it was a little bit long, is that I was hired because there is a Byzantine component in Central Europe, and I think I initiated what we can call Drang nach Osten, the push toward the East, that, you know, that push continued and finally reached India. And yeah. Now we have absolutely excellent Indian students, super Indian students.
Yeah, I could see that happy experience in your eyes. Unfortunately, our listeners cannot. So you've already mentioned that you are trained in late antique philosophy and patristic. And you're also trained in ancient Greek. But you have so many titles associated with you. Like, for example, you're a Byzantinist, you're a philologist, and an ancient philosopher who is specialized in Plato, Plotinus, Dionysus the Areopagite, Origen, to mention a few. And you're also a Syriacist. So my question is, how do you like to be known?
No idea. That's a terrible dispersion. And there are 2 causes for that. One is curiosity, and the other is CEU. Because I learned so much from the students. So I had to supervise subjects about which I have never understood. And because, now it's not the case, but at the beginning it was so, that all the other members of the department were Western and Central European scholars and Latinists. So whatever was east of this was my responsibility at the beginning. I had to supervise an incredible number of students, because if someone was working on old Russian, then it was Perzel. I knew Russian from school, so I could read the old Russian text, why not? But of course it was not my specialty. If it was anything Eastern, of course it was an unbearable situation, and then I was lobbying intensely for hiring other specialists, and which has happened. I don't say it has happened because of me. It has happened because it was a need. But then we hired, and now you know that there is, I'm not, now we have basically 3 Syriacists at the department, Volker Mentze, okay, in the source language teaching group, Malfono Ephraim, and me. We have Ottoman studies, we have late antique studies, not only for the West. We have proper Byzantine studies chair, not an amateur, but a Byzantinist as I am. But at that time, everything was my responsibility. So I had to read one thesis after the other. I had to discuss it with them. there came one of my favorite students, Levan Giginashvili, who is now director of the Institute for Classical Byzantine and Modern Greek Studies at the State University of Tbilisi. And he came as a young MA student, and I asked him what he wanted to do. He said, well, there are several possibilities, either this, either that. Or there is Ioanne Petrici, who has translated The Elements of Theology of Proclus. I've never heard about this. Mm-hmm. What? A Georgian philosopher in the 12th century translating the most influential work of the Athenian Diadochus of Plato, Proclus, who died in 485. And I said, this is what you should do. He had no idea what to do. And then we began to work on Petrici. But that was the first time I heard of it. Now, after that, he defended an interesting MA thesis, just like you. And then a PhD, which we later published in the United States, and which was the first comprehensive monograph on Petrici in English. Mm-hmm. And we continue the work. Every week we are sitting together and translating, almost since then. No, there was an interruption. But now for years we have been sitting and translating Petrici's Georgian translation of the Elements of Theology with his commentaries. Mm-hmm. And I have just received the contract to sign from Brill for the first volume of our publication. So you understand, it was the medieval studies at CU which gave me the opportunity to delve into so many things. And this is a horrible dispersion, because I could have published I don't know how many monographs on Dionysius Areopagite. But it's more interesting like this, and to have this overview. And I am really very satisfied with this career, and I'm very grateful to basically Gábor Klanicai and the late János Bak, who made this terrible mistake of hiring me for some Byzantine component in Central Europe.
That's a nice story to hear. So in the year 2000, you started a digitization process for digitizing the manuscripts and the Syrian Christian heritage in India.
Yeah.
And it was a long journey. I think it's still going on.
Oh, it is now flourishing. It's now that the real things will begin.
Yeah, so tell us about your experience with the project and how it is going and everything.
Should I begin just like I began the previous story with how it began?
Yeah.
Because it was again beginning coincidentally.
Yeah.
I already mentioned the Caucasian students.
Mm-hmm.
So I owe this digitization project to one of the Georgian students, Irma Karaulashvili. Because Irma Karaulashvili was working on Apocrypha, basically an Armenian apocryphon of the Doctrina Haddai, about the correspondence of Christ with King Abgar of Edessa, whatever. It's a very famous apocryphon. And she wrote a thesis. I understood that it was, of course, I had a little idea. I understood that it was good, but I did not know what exactly it was. It was under my supervision. So I sent it to the foremost experts in this. One of them was Alain Deremo, who worked on the Syriac Doctrine of Haddai, and the other was Bernard Utier, who was a Georgian and Armenian specialist. Now, they wrote me back. They were reading this fantastic thesis, and they want immediately to offer its publication and whatever. And so I got in touch with them. And then I began to speak to Alain Deremo. And I asked him, because I have heard about Syria Christian at India, but, you know, only some legends. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, does he know anything about this? Oh, he said, I am working on that. Mm-hmm. And do this and that. Go to St. Ephrem Ecumenical Research Institute. There is a conference just now. I went, I presented on Syriac version of Pseudo-Dionysius. And then they took us to to a tour, seeing the manuscript archives of the church manuscript archives, to the Konat Library, mm-hmm. to Trishur, Maraprem's Library, Mannanam. Mm-hmm. That was the first time. It was in 1998. Mm-hmm. And there was this, that there are all these manuscripts, who knows how many. There have been studies, but very little study has been done. What should we do? It should be cataloged, but how? And then it was the time. I came back. The department had a technical associate, Tamás Sajó. Mm-hmm. I talked to him and he said, digitizing. I never heard about digitizing. And then we started it in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. It was very adventurous. I don't want to describe the adventures because at the end, I must admit, I fell out with Alain Dérimo, I fell out with Tamás Sajó, but this is how we began. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many times I regret it. It was so difficult.
No, but now you don't, right?
No, but it was very difficult, and I did many crazy things. For example, I took my family with the four children to India mm-hmm. to be able to do the digitization. It was really, for this reason, I have not been for 30 years at the department. 5 years with the Indian project, mm-hmm. 1 year in Jerusalem, 1 year in Bochum, and so on and so on. But because it was also an incredible chance. Nowhere else could it have been done, because we had a rector, mm-hmm. Yehuda Elkama. And Yehuda's principle was that research is more important than teaching. So he gave me 6 year unpaid leave to do to do my research and kept my position. Mm-hmm. I think nowhere else and in no other circumstances could it have been done. Even now, if I were, I think, to ask a rector, I want a 6 year unpaid leave, I wouldn't get it.
So can you tell us about some of the yields that you got out of this research, some of the special discoveries that you would like to discuss, or some special experiences?
Okay. As everything is coincidental, or you can say fate or providence, what were my expectations? I thought I will find the old, long-lost historical records or texts which have been lost in the Middle East and were preserved in India. And this was not perfectly... So I was not perfectly disappointed. But the most important things which I found were things I have never dreamed about. Mm-hmm. What to mention first. I have written about these things. So I think one of my discoveries there is classical Syriac as an early modern and modern lingua franca in India. So when Syriac scholarship was more or less declining in the Middle East, it gained incredible importance in India mm-hmm. because of the special conditions, the great respect that the local Malayali Christians paid to Syriac, mm-hmm. and the missionary context. And there were coincidences there as well, because it turns out that before the Portuguese landed, because mm-hmm. before Vasco da Gama landed in 1498 in Calicut, mm-hmm. for a long while there was no connection between the Church of the East, the mother church of the Christians in Kerala, and Kerala. Mm. And that was renewed in, I think, 1490. Mm-hmm. So just 90 or 92, I don't remember clearly, just some years mm-hmm. before the arrival of Vasco da Gama, who has not encountered the Christians, by the way. It was Pedro Alvarez Cabral who in 1500 who discovered the Christians for whom they were looking. The connection with the Mother Church and Syriac learning was renewed just before the arrival of the Portuguese. But they found already a flourishing Syriac culture. But it was quite recent, because it was almost extinct, and then it was renewed. And then Syriac was in so high esteem that when the European missionaries started their missionary campaigns and started all kinds of things, everything failed. There came the Jesuits, and the Jesuits were very keen on translating things to the vernacular, learning the languages, giving European things in vernacular to the missionized people, but they were complaining. Give to these people something in their mother tongue, they don't accept it. Give to them something in Syriac, and then they accept it.
Mm-hmm.
The Western missionaries were forced to learn Syriac and translate things and write things in Syriac. So you know, because you are dealing with the, precisely this is your PhD thesis, a grand literary work of the great Jesuit Syriacist Francisco Rose.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the literary work of Francisco Rose in Syriac and in Malayalam, this is my discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, I had an intuition after my first contact with Malayali Christians. This was a very strong intuition that all this legendary story about the Portuguese Synod of Dayampere in 1599, condemning the local books of the Christians and burning them, that this is a myth. You can't imagine what kind of difficulties I had with your fellow local Malayalis. You want to do something, a work, they say yes, but they mean no. They are cheating you, they are obstructing it, they are despising you because you are a saip. But they are very polite with you because you are a saip, so saip, you know, for the weaker minds, this is sahib in northern India, and it means foreigner. And then I said, this is wonderful. This means that these people have never given their manuscripts to those stupid Portuguese who wanted to burn them. So we have to go and see what has survived. And there is an incredible harvest. They have the Christians under this oppression of the missionizing, Latinizing Portuguese, have preserved their literature. The more it was condemned, the more they were preserving it. But there was more, which I did not expect, that the Portuguese were not as stupid as they looked like. And although perhaps they made some showcase of burning books, there were scholars there, like Francisco Rose.
Mm-hmm.
A scholar would never burn a book. So what they did was they confiscated the books and kept them in a library. And I have traced this library, and the latest traces of it could be found by the end of the 19th century. The books confiscated after the Synod of Dayampere were still kept there.
Mm-hmm.
And I could identify only two of them.
Okay.
Unfortunately, there are legends about what happened to this library. That was the Carmelite Library of Verapoli, Varapura.
Mm-hmm.
I was hunting these books together with my friend Father Ignatius Paiapilli, going everywhere, interrogating people, but nothing else than legends could I hear. But there are two books, one in the Cambridge Library and one in the Archdiocesan Library of Ernakulam, which are definitively from this library, which the Portuguese Jesuits, so they were not all Portuguese, so the Jesuits kept first at Waipikotta, their seminary, and which later, when the Jesuits were ousted from India, were transferred to Warapura, to the Carmelite Library. And there they were at least until the end of the 19th century. Luckily, Claudius Buchanan, British missionary from Kolkata, who made a travel to Kerala, luckily he stole one of these books. And this is in Cambridge in the Buchanan collection. And another book was stolen by the first Siro Malabar bishop, Mar Louis Paraparambil, when he was expelled from the Carmelite order because of his nativist views. And apparently, Mar Louis Paraparambil, when he was expelled, also stole a book from the library. And that book, very important book, is in the Ernakulam Archdiocesan Library. These are all my discoveries. I discovered for scholarship, although it was known in India, Garshuni Malayalam. You are dealing with that. We are the only center in the world doing Garshuni Malayalam studies.
Yeah, it's indeed a very privileged position that I'm in, that I should admit. Yeah, so can you elaborate on your recent works and the recent research that you've been doing?
Which one?
The Indian, the other ones. The Indian you have already explained, so maybe.
Okay. My main research is not India. This was coincidental and an opportunity, which was first a horrible obligation because everything came against me at the beginning. It was almost hopeless, but finally we survived. But here I have to say a name, because the whole thing would have collapsed many times were it not for one person in India, and this is Maraprem Mukken, the Nestorian Metropolitan of Thrissur. Without his friendship, paternal sponsorship, his wish to make the Indian Syrian Christian heritage known to the world, I would have given up 100 times. But he never allowed me to do so. He said, this is your task, you do it. And he helped. So he is an incredible man. Okay, but my big research is on Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, who was considered the first systematic theologian of the Christian Church. But it's a fake that everybody knows, but people don't really want to realize what it is. Because by the end of the 19th century, two German scholars have demonstrated that Dionysius the Areopagite is the Athenian convert of St. Paul. His story is told very succinctly in the 17th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles. Tradition held he was the first bishop of Athens, consecrated by St. Paul. And then, sometime, and apparently by the beginning of the 6th century, people began to refer to the writings of St. Dionysius the Areopagite. It was in the heat of the Christological controversies by the beginning of the 6th century. And soon it was accepted, this great authority, these very mystical, very obscure works, but very having quality. Without quality, a fake is not accepted. And it was by the end of the 19th century that two German scholars were able to prove that this is a late 5th, perhaps early 6th century forgery. I call it a late antique literary fiction. And that it plagiarizes the aforementioned Proclus, whose pupil he must have been. I have been working. Especially, my aim was, and this started in the early 1990s, this research, was to, nobody could ever understand who this person was who made this fake. Because it's so mysterious, you have a fantastic literature attributing the ideas of each scholar who has dealt with this to Dionysius. Because it's so underdetermined as long as we don't know where it comes from and what it is, that you can read into it whatever you want. And this was, how to say, this situation was responsible for the fact that it became such a fundamental text of theology. Because it was a great authority, the pupil of St. Paul, and at the same time difficult to understand. So for every theological trend, they could read into it what they wanted. But my crazy idea was that this is not a good situation, and this continues in scholarship. Let us find out who he was. My discoveries came in a row, but they were so incredible that they are not yet accepted. But I got a lot of citations in refutations. My idea was, if it was written by the end of the 5th century and the early 6th century, then he could not have been unaffected by the theological quarrels, the theological fights which were raging at that time, namely the Christological controversy and the Origenist controversy. So I was looking for that, what was his position, because that was also very vague. People attribute to him an ironic position, he didn't want to take sides. What I have found out was, first, that he belonged to that movement which later, in the mid-6th century, was condemned as Origenist heresy. I published the first articles about this in French in 1997. It was a huge scandal. The great church father, you know, who is an Origenist heretic. But what I understood almost simultaneously was that not only he belonged to the Origenist movement, but he was also on the so-called Nestorian side. Everybody thought he was the opposite. I don't know why, by the way, and I have written about this, that it's so obvious. This evolved into a later big project, which I am pursuing, of tracing the history of the Origenist movement, its condemnations, its survival. And finally, I came to the conclusion, and this is the most important thing, that what was several times condemned under the vile name of Origenism, because poor Origen was poor Origen, the Alexandrian teacher of the 3rd century, was made a scapegoat for this, is nothing else than par excellence Christian Platonism. It's a philosophical movement comparable to the Neoplatonist, pagan Neoplatonist philosophy. It's a philosophical movement within the Christian Church, which had difficult fate. Some among its representatives were condemned as heretics. Others among its representatives were celebrated as saints. And it has always survived. I think it survives up to the present day. Because this is, I would call, par excellence Christian philosophy. You see that I began as tracing this as a heresy, and everybody was very upset. And I ended up in being converted to this movement because I love it. Patrizi, John Italos in Byzantium, St. Maximus the Confessor, St. Gregory of Nazianzus, of course, Evagrius of Pontus, and so on, all these big names, partly saint, partly condemned in the Chalcedonian Church and considered saints in your church, in the Syrian Orthodox Church, they belong to this philosophical movement. And that's a grand philosophy. So this is my main research now. Just to finish, I am writing now an essay on, is there a Platonist philosophical life in Christ, which I want to publish in St. Vladimir's Theological Quarterly. I have just proposed it, but I have not yet finished it, where I want to analyze what did the church lose when it discarded this movement.
So I would like to thank you for sharing your incredible experiences with your students at the department and your research. and everything that you shared. And thank you for being here, and thank you for being a part of this interview.